it's episode 150 of the Cricket Her Weekly today.
Episode 150. Wow, we're old.
I don't think it's got anything to do with age. We're persistent. Anyway, welcome to episode 150 of the Cricket Her Weekly. Thanks for joining us, as ever. And we are going to start this week's episode with a couple of questions that have been sent in from viewers. The first question is from Christian Barrow, and it relates to the Under-19 World Cup. So think back to a week ago, Sid, when we were in the throes of that. So he says, were the pitches overused at the tournament? Spin dominated at the end with really low scores across the knockout ties. Should fresher pitches and more venues have been available?
I think it's a really interesting question, and I think that, ideally you probably would have wanted fresh pitches for those final games. And I think that it's partly, you know, it's a money thing. Like, is it worth spending money on that? You know, they produced a really big tournament that involved a lot of teams.
Yeah.
You know, that's where they chose to focus that, and that meant that kind of contracting it in to just use a couple of venues and a couple of grounds. I also think that it's really easy to look at those games now and think, well, they were low scoring games the last couple of games of the tournament. But that's actually normal for tournament cricket, right? The last two World Cups, the 2020 World Cup final in 2020 at the MCG, the World Cup final in New Zealand, were both really high scoring games, those finals. But those finals were massive outliers. Finals are usually more like 2017, when England won that World Cup, where at the halfway point, we were like, England haven't scored anything like enough runs here.
That's
India
right,
have won this game already. So it's normal for those final games to be low scoring, particularly in this case where, you know, the batters were actually, in England batters, you know, were facing decent bowlers for only the second time in the tournament after facing Australia's bowlers in the semi-final, and India's in the final. And so inevitably those scores are going to be lower. You know, but I think, yeah, in an ideal world, we definitely use more pitches, but it's partly a question of where you focus the resources. And I think I wouldn't want to criticise the ICC too much here. I think that the resources largely went into the right place.
Okay, thanks for that, Sid. We've got another question from Martin Saxon on a completely different topic, but again, it's something that we were discussing in the podcast last week, which was about the 100 scheduling. And the fact that this year they haven't scheduled any of the women's matches to be after the men's matches. It's all with the women first and then the men second. And he says, you mentioned optics in the context of 100 match scheduling, but then didn't go on to say what I thought was coming. From your experience of watching games where the men were on first, was there a mass exodus after the first game? That could be the kind of optics that could give the women's game in general a bad name. I think this is a really interesting question, and it's certainly something that we were worried would happen. And I think we even might have discussed it in the Cricket Her Weekly about a concern that if you play the women's match second, then there is that feeling that if, you know, the women are then coming on and they're having to watch people leave, that could be very demoralising and not good from a kind of PR perspective.
And that definitely happened in some of the double headers that were where they double headed blast matches with regional matches.
Did it?
That did happen there, but
it didn't happen in the 100. Well, actually, we were at one of the double header games where the women's game was playing second. We were at the one at the Oval, which was the first one. So it was a big experiment, and nobody quite knew what would happen. And actually, what was really interesting was that pretty much almost everybody stayed. I think they had a crowd of like 20,000 for the men's game, and almost all of them stayed for the women's game. And in fact, what actually happened was that they had a bit of a mad rush at the end because Surrey hadn't employed enough stewards to stay for the duration of the women's game. And there was a big hoo-ha.
They'd assumed that a lot more people were going
to
leave.
Exactly, they'd assumed
did.
That people would leave at that halfway point, and so they didn't need to pay all of these stewards to stay for another couple of hours while the women's game was played. And actually, what happened was that lots of people did stay, and so it was all a bit of a mad rush getting out of the ground at the end after the women's match. So that was really interesting, and kind of upended expectations slightly. So that's one of the reasons why I'm slightly confused and not really sure why they haven't gone with having some of the women's matches played afterwards, because I don't think it did have that kind of negative impact that we were slightly worried it might have. But thank you, Martin and Christian, for your questions. And please keep sending in questions because we enjoy answering them. It gives us something to talk about, doesn't it, Sid? It gives us something to do of a Sunday. Okay, now it's the World Cup, Sid, starting in a few days' time. Did you know that?
It is, yeah. We're off to South Africa on Wednesday evening.
Is that why we're going?
Yeah.
For the World Cup? Good.
Apparently.
Okay, yes. So we're not going to do an in-depth preview of the tournament because we're actually going to do a special episode of the Cricket Hurl Weekly. We're probably going to do it on Friday, which is the day of the first game, and it will have given us a chance to get our bearings, etc. So we will do a preview episode that talks about team prospects, etc. at that point. But there has been a big bit of news this week that I think we should really talk about. And it does relate to the conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago about Danne van Niekerk being ruled out of the tri-series on fitness grounds. Now, as it transpires, this week the news broke that she's been omitted from their World Cup squad. And the reason is because she's failed a 2 kilometre time trial by 18 seconds. 18 seconds, Sid. It's not very long, is it? It's a bit of an odd one. And I've got to say, I'm not really sure that we've got the whole story yet. I don't really have any grounds on which to base that, other than what seems obvious to me is that somebody at some point has imposed this new time requirement on the players.
Yeah, that's the first important thing to say. Yeah. This is a new requirement.
New requirement that's just been brought in. I think on Crick Info it said that it'd been brought in December, okay, that the women have to now run 2 kilometres in 9 minutes 30 seconds, okay? So, and the men have to do it in 8 minutes 30 seconds. So they've reduced it by 30 seconds. So Danne van Niekerk has never met this requirement ever in her entire kind of 10-year career playing international cricket for South Africa. She ran a personal best, but it still wasn't enough to meet this requirement. And somebody somewhere set that requirement, somebody at Cricket South Africa presumably set that requirement, knowing that she was going to find it really difficult to meet it.
Yeah, they created a bar, yeah, basically, that they knew that she was going to struggle to jump over. And it's like, why do you create the bar there? There's lots of places they could have set that bar. Yeah. If they'd set that bar just like, you know, 20 seconds more, then she'd have jumped it.
Exactly. And, I don't like to be somebody who peddles conspiracy theories. People who've read my Twitter feed recently may beg to differ, but normally it's slightly tongue-in-cheek. But, I mean, Cricket South Africa have not exactly made themselves look particularly trustworthy, given what happened with the Lizelle Lee situation, which ended up in, Hilton Mareng saying in a press conference one thing, me tweeting he'd said this, Lizelle Lee then replying to my tweet saying, no, that's a lie, he did know this, etc, etc. Now, we never quite got to the bottom of exactly what happened there, but it was clear that there was something more going on that we didn't know about, that we weren't told in the media. And so, forgive me for not necessarily taking everything that Cricket South Africa say at face value about this instance as well.
Now, she failed it by just this trial by just 18 seconds. So she ran 2 kilometres in what, 9:48, that means?
Yeah.
So now I run regularly, and actually, interestingly, in terms of like running speeds, a 30-year-old woman, which is roughly what Danne is actually equivalent to a 50-year-old man, which is roughly what I am. And for me, the idea of running 2 kilometres in, I run 6 times a week. I do 5 kilometres at least 6 times a week. And the idea of running it that fast is just ridiculous. My personal best ever, I did about 5 years ago for a 10K, was 6 minutes per kilometre. So it's way quicker than that. And so to me, that feels like a ridiculously fast requirement. But is that is 9:30 ridiculously fast?
So if you did 6 minutes a kilometre, then you would have done... Oh, no.
No, because it was 10 kilometres, okay. Raf.
Sorry.
Anyway... So, you've been actually digging into how fast this actually is, because although it feels really fast to me, I mean, she'd be going around the track much faster than I would.
Yeah, and me.
But, there's a but, isn't there, Raf?
Yeah, one of the things that we struggled with was about how do you put this in context in terms of what is actually expected of cricketers. But we have found out that in the English system, in the English regional setup, every single player in the regional setup, we are told, would meet this requirement. And some of them would do it a lot quicker. Some of them might do it in 7:30, but they would definitely all meet the requirement of doing it in 9:30. Now, I know that one of the points that you were discussing, Sid, was actually about the fact that Danne van Niekerk hasn't been professional for all of her career, and that we perhaps need to take that into account. On the other hand, some of these regional players have been professional for only a year or so, and they are still able to meet this. Where I think that is interesting, if you look at what England do compared with cricket South Africa, is actually that I asked the ECB about this, and I said, what would happen if one of your England players wasn't meeting this? And it wouldn't be automatic grounds for exclusion in the way it apparently is now in South Africa. It would be one of a range of measures. It would be taken into account, of course, but say you were coming back from injury, it would be one of a range of measures that they would use to assess whether they thought that you were match fit. It wouldn't be, oh, you're 18 seconds over, therefore you're automatically disqualified. Now, that's not to say that it wouldn't be taken into account, but it's a slightly more flexible system. It also feels like, from what I've heard from people in the English system, that it's a much more individualised assessment. And I think that's one of the issues that I've got with this Van Niekerk thing, is that actually you need to be taking people into account more as an individual and thinking about, you know, what do you bring to the team? If you're somebody in that South African squad who, you know, maybe isn't 100% sure of your place in the 11, if you're, I don't know, I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, but say you're like Nadine de Klerk or Laura Goodall or somebody like that who maybe isn't necessarily 100% established in the team, you're going to want to be not just meeting those fitness targets, but smashing them, because you have to make a case for yourself why you deserve to be in the team, right?
Yep.
If you're Danne van Niekerk and you are like, you know, the best tactician they've got, the best captain they've got, you know, somebody who's amassed a load of runs for them and somebody who is also able to contribute with your bowling, actually, if you take all those things in the round, is that really, you know, can you really then look at that person and say, oh, but you're not able to run as quickly as all of these other people? And so I think that's my take on it.
Okay. Interesting.
Okay. But, Sid, South Africa did win the Tri Series against India. We watched the final, I think it was on Friday. They won the final of the Tri Series. And that was only a couple of days after all of this had emerged. So you would think that if it was going to impact on them, would it have impacted someone on them in that Tri Series final?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's a bit too easy for South Africa fans to look at that Tri Series and go, look, you know, I mean, it's a great result for them, and they're going to go, you know, go into the World Cup with a bit of a confidence boost.
Yeah.
But I think that you have to kind of look at that result, you know, and go, well, you know, how many times are India only going to score 110 in a T20? I mean, it obviously wasn't the easiest pitch to bat on, but nevertheless, the number of times that you're going to be chasing that lower total against a side like India is just not going to happen very often. And it's not like they made the total in 8 overs, right? Despite Chloe Tryon hitting out and, you know, having one of the best innings of her career,
yeah,
and scoring quickly, they still only got there with a couple of overs to spare. So I wouldn't get overexcited about that, honestly. India have a bit of a wake-up call for them. Mm. They'll play that badly, you know, once in every 2 or 3 years. I'm afraid that's the once, you know.
Okay, well, that's
if South Africa meet them again, it's going to be more like the other match in the Tri Series where India knocked them all over the park.
Effectively, this Tri Series has been World Cup warm-ups. I know they've been official internationals, but, you know, it's a bit like looking at the England v New Zealand World Cup warm-ups and saying, oh, that's going to dictate form going into the World Cup. Well, let's hope it isn't, because both sides keep being consistently bowled out in those games for under 100. So I think that we all have to hope that, you know, they'll put on a little bit of a better showing in the actual thing. So I think, you know, warm-ups, you have to take them with a bit of a pinch of salt, take them in context, and not necessarily read too much into them. And the problem with the way that Cricket South Africa have handled this whole thing is that it's a home World Cup, loads of scrutiny, loads of focus on them. If they put a foot wrong, then everyone is going to be looking around going, where's Danne van Niekerk, can't they?
Yeah, no, and it's going to be the obvious thing for journalists to turn to, yeah, if it doesn't go well for them. And, you know, despite this good result in the final, I mean, we'll talk about more of this in our preview episode, but I'm not backing South Africa, unfortunately, for this one.
Okay. I did listen to the No Balls podcast this week, and they did a bit of a special episode talking about the World Cup, and they did talk about the Danne van Niekerk incident or news story. And what was really interesting was that Kate Cross said that she thought it was really unfair that Cricket South Africa had released the information, or that the information had been made public about Danne failing that 2 km time trial, because she was like, well, if it was me, then I would consider that to be personal information and I'd be really embarrassed. So I'm going to use that as a kind of jumping off point to segue into our next talking point, because, Sid, there's been a bit of a news story this week about about personal data and cricket, and you did a Twitter thread on it. Do you want to just fill us in?
Yes, this is a really interesting story in The Guardian that the Professional Cricketers Association are working with a legal firm to attempt to assert ownership of the cricket stats data to the players themselves.
Right.
So what they're saying is that we think that under English law, which is what, you know, will apply here in these cases, that the players themselves own their stats data. So, you know, if you're a player, you know, the number of runs you've scored, the number of overs you've bowled, the number of wickets you've taken, you own that data under something called GDPR. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I've actually, in my day job as a computer guy, I've actually done quite a lot of work on GDPR because it's all about data collection and data processing. And, you know, it's a really interesting question that has been raised here. GDPR was a law that was intended to protect your personal data from rapacious internet firms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, where you're possibly watching this video, from collecting all the data about you without your consent and then selling it.
Yeah.
What GDPR said was that that those big companies need to get consent to use your personal data, like what websites you've been on and things, in order to collate that data and then sell it to other people, mm-hmm. or to use it for their own purposes, to kind of feed you new videos or new tweets or what have you. Now, what the PCA and their lawyers are saying is, aha, we can use this mm-hmm. to say that runs scored and everything are personal data, and that therefore the players own them, and therefore if you're collecting this personal data, hello companies like CricInfo and CricViz, if you're collecting that, you need to pay the players for that. And so, it's a really interesting legal argument. And I think that legally there probably is something to it. You know, it's clearly not what the law was intended for, but the law could be used to express that. And that will mean what they're trying to do, basically, essentially, let's not beat around the bush. They're trying to shake down the likes of CricViz and go, look, CricViz, you're making loads of money here out of our data, our players. You know, you're being paid. I mean, we know that CricViz are being paid by several of the WPL teams to advise on what players to purchase in the WPL auction, for example. You're making loads of money out of this. We want a cut of that.
But this is bonkers. Okay, so what you're saying is that for The Guardian, I'm going to turn up to a match and I'm going to be like, right, Marizan Kapp took 5 for 30 today, and that's her personal data, so I can't use it.
Well, that's not quite right, because okay. there is an exemption for journalistic purposes. So you can quote known facts, but what they are saying is that if you collated that information alongside other players, in other words, if you kept, you might call it a card with a score on it. I'm going to call it a card score, perhaps?
A scorecard.
That's snappier, actually, Rav. I like that. Copyright that. If you kept a scorecard, then that you'd be collating that personal data, and then you would be potentially breaching their rights
this
under GDPR.
This is absolutely bonkers, Sid. I cannot believe that any court of law would uphold this. No, actually, I can, because sometimes the law's mad, isn't it? But my goodness, this just smacks to me of some people who are very well paid, thank you very much, which also applies to the England women nowadays, they're going to have more money in their pockets, and I'm going to have less money in my pocket because it's going to really impact my ability to do journalism.
Yeah, no, and it would mean things like the fact that, you know, that all the player rankings data that we produce, that definitely is collating what they are arguing is personal data. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to produce those things anymore. So I definitely think that this is potentially a problem because, you know, obviously the very biggest companies, people like CricViz, will just pay up. Because at the end of the day, the PCA have got no interest in bankrupting CricViz over this. What they want is a share of the money. They don't want to bankrupt CricViz because then there's no money to share.
Yeah.
So they will set the price at what the likes of CricViz can afford. But obviously, you know,
we can't.
A tiny business like us that's just us that, you know, makes a few hundred pounds a year and that is not going to be able to pay that level of tax to be able to access the personal data and wouldn't be able to do it. Now, it has to be said, this is a long way from going to even going into a legal process. They're just talking about that process at the moment.
Okay.
And I think that probably what the PCA are hoping is that CricViz will come to an agreement with them and just quietly pay up and, you know, they won't have to ever go to court or anything. If it does go to court, well, we'd see what happens. But there are definitely some very unfortunate implications if it does.
Right. To keep our eyes peeled on that one. Now, finally this week, Sid, The ICC have been proudly proclaiming that this World Cup is going to be the first World Cup all umpired and officiated by women. First thing to say is that that's actually wrong, because believe it or not, women's cricket did actually exist before the ICC took over in 2005, and the first ever World Cup entirely umpired by women was the first ever World Cup in 1973. Anyway, I have made that point on Twitter. Hopefully I have corrected the historical record.
But yeah, this was a particular thing about the Women's Cricket Association in this country, wasn't it, Raf?
Yes.
Because in other countries, so when the World Cup, when the first World Cups went to Australia and things, there were male umpires, is that right?
Yeah, were, yes. But the Women's Cricket Association in this country always had a policy that they would only use female umpires to umpire in internationals. We did have lots of men working in the club game, working in county cricket, but at internationals it was reserved for women.
That's
so the ICC are wrong about that. However, they are correct that it's the first ever ICC tournament, or ICC T20 tournament, to be umpired entirely by women. And they have made a big song and dance about it. They've obviously decided that this is a really exciting thing. What do you make of it, Sid?
Oh, I think that overall it's, you know, it's positive. I mean, there's a little bit of positive discrimination going on here. I mean, some people have made the point that if you take this to its logical conclusion, then the Men's World Cup would be entirely umpired by men. And, you know, that's not right. But I think that it's important to have some degree of positive discrimination, which kind of helps the women to move forward. Jarrett Kimber did a really interesting piece about this, which you can go off and find on Twitter. He's done a little video about it.
Well, we can put it in the show notes.
We can. And he had some thoughts on it. I mean, it's important to say that what Jared said is that, you know, overall he can see that the ICC are trying to do the right thing, and that, but his concern is that the women are being hung out to dry slightly, because he feels that they're perhaps, you're putting people who are not yet sufficiently experienced to be umpiring at this level, you know, out there, and, you know, expecting them to do a job with all of the scrutiny that they're going to get. Now, I feel that experience is like has too much of a premium in umpiring.
Okay,
so
that's interesting.
I think that we can look at someone like Anna Harris and go, well, Anna Harris, you know, is in her mid-20s still and has only been umpiring for a few years, and she's going to be out there umpiring the first game next Friday. You know, is her lack of experience a problem? And I actually don't think it is. And the reason I don't think it is that things have changed. Things have moved on. Women lacking experience is always something that middle-aged white men tend to say when they, you know, they want to try and protect their turf. Like, of course we would give these minorities and these women, we would give them the opportunities, but unfortunately they lack experience. So we had to appoint another middle-aged white man. Terribly sad.
And Raj, you just did an impression of yourself.
Said the middle-aged white man. But the important thing to note is that what that experience relates to is, in practice, it's LBW decisions.
Yeah.
So what we're really talking about is that you need to see a lot of balls delivered in order to kind of get the feel of how LBWs work, how cricket balls work and all that, and the experience, you know, that you get from, you know, being at the end of a pitch for 30 years it outweighs anything. Actually, I don't think it does anymore.
Okay.
If you're smart and studious, like Anna Harris, and we know that she's smart and studious because she got into medical school, and you don't get into medical school in this country without being smart and studious, you can, you know, go to the ICC's official training materials for umpires, and you can watch thousands of LBW decisions through on video. You can watch them with the ball tracking, which, you know, tells you, you know, exactly where the ball was going, and you can build that experience by yourself. So I think the experience, you know, is a little bit overrated. And there's actually a lot of other benefits from umpiring that you get from being younger. I mean, it's the simple fact that your eyesight is better, right? Anna Harris's eyesight is better.
Of course.
Than Anna Harris's eyesight will be in 20 years' time, because your eyes deteriorate.
This is why in some
ways, her hearing's better.
This is why in some ways it's very odd that most of the umpires that we've had historically in elite cricket are older people.
It's always about the premium placed on experience of making LBW decisions.
But clearly your eyesight deteriorates as you get older.
Yeah.
I mean, I
so
guess...
So I think that it's not a problem. I think the experience thing is not an issue. And, you know, good luck to all those women going out there and, you know, smash it.
Yeah. All I would say is that if you're a really good umpire, male or female, you shouldn't be kind of streamed into doing men's or women's cricket. You shouldn't be, what's the word I'm looking for, pigeonholed into doing one or the other. I think it's great to have high-level female umpires, but you know, why can't Anna Harris go and be umpiring in the Men's World Cup?
Yeah,
and she's the best umpire.
She may well be, you know, on her current career trajectory, she'll be umpiring a World Cup final before we know it.
Yeah, probably this one, Sid, in about 3 weeks' time. I would be really unsurprised because it's all done on based on merit and she's clearly a really good umpire. Anyway, we better wrap up there because we've wanged on long enough for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in, and next time you see us, we'll be in South Africa. See you then.
See you there.